All right. I appreciate, first of all those of you who gave me some feedback, just to get a sense as to how it went last week. What we're going to do is this week is build a little bit on what we discussed, some of the things last week. The main idea that I wanted to get across was a bunch of concepts that none of which were probably unique or new or novel in the sense of, like, I never heard of that before, but to give terminology that puts people, couples specifically, on the same page so that they know, in a word, what's going on. It allows, once you have terminology, similar terminology, in which you understand the same ideas, it allows for being able to explain different types of situations much easier. That was the introvert-extrovert idea, you know, the honey and the chola and soda bottle. Those kinds of examples just sort of explain situations as they come up and hopefully allow us to address them. So what I'd like to introduce tonight, this is the first time for me introducing this concept, is based on a book that I came across a while ago and have been waiting for the right opportunity to address it. Is going to be a similar concept. It's not going to be anything new. It's not going to be novel in the sense, like, I never heard that before, but I think it has a tremendous role to play in a marriage. And when a couple is on the same page and being able to identify certain things that are going on will be extremely, extremely helpful to doing so. That is a concept of what we'll call a crucial conversation. This workshop is specifically going to be focused on what we can call a conflict management or something along those lines. At the core of that is what we're going to call a crucial conversation. Now, I didn't make that up. I brought in the book that I got that from. It's a wonderful book. There are a bunch of different authors. Four different authors put this together. It's called Crucial Conversations. If you want to get the in-depth version of it, read it inside. What I'm going to do is, you know, there's a Gemara that says, you know, there are 613 mitzvahs that were given to Moshe at Har Sinai, and then the Gemara goes through a list of Nevi'im who came, and they whittled it down to really, it's 11 major principles. No, it's really 9 major principles. It's 7, it's 6, all the way down to 1 major principle. So they don't mean to say that the 613 don't apply, but they're just giving you, this is what it's all about, this is the core. So I'm going to give a small attempt to whittle it down into 1, 2, 3 basic concepts, although in its entirety the book is a wonderful book, I highly recommend it. It's much more complex than what we'll address a little bit tonight. What is a crucial conversation? How does it relate to a marriage? So a crucial conversation, as we're going to be discussing it tonight, is a basic idea that we're familiar with in our lives, not only in our marriages, in our business world as well, with our friends. There are certain conversations that we have which are extremely significant. They're emotionally charged, the stakes are high, and there are different opinions about it. It's simply, there's a reality that we step into those conversations, and when we hit those conversations, they are fundamentally different than our regular run-of-the-mill, shooting-the-breeze kind of conversation. Sometimes a crucial conversation happens in an organized manner. You set up a meeting with your rav, with your doctor, with a principal, and you know this is going to be intense. It's set up that way. It's going to be an intense conversation. It's not going to be simple, and everybody steps into it prepared for it. In life, it often happens totally out of the blue. You're just having a regular staff meeting at the office, and somebody brings up a new way of doing things, and before you know it, there was an explosion. And you're trying to figure out what happened, and the conversation became intense. It became emotionally charged, and the stakes were very high. And those conversations are critical. Because in those conversations, they're called crucial conversations for a reason, there's a lot at stake. And managing those conversations are key. And in a marriage, I would venture to suggest this is one of the key elements in terms of navigating. In a marriage, they almost never are set up as meetings like you would with your principal, where you, like, you have a set time and you get together at 3 o'clock and everybody comes and you wait in the waiting room and you show up and, okay, who wants to go first? It usually doesn't happen that way. It's like sort of over dinner, you're just having this random conversation, and then all of a sudden, oh yeah, we need to discuss Pesach at your parents' this year. Woo-hoo-hoo. And then before you know it, like Pesach and the in-laws, and it's a major conversation as to how are we going to manage this? And the stakes get very high, very fast. Emotions run very high, very fast, and it's a critical moment as to where is this relationship going to go. You know, where is our child going to go to school? There's an issue happening. What do we do with him? So sometimes you actually sit down and have a meeting, but it doesn't always work that way. And before you know it, you end up in a crucial, critical conversation, or you have to just bring something up. You have a complaint that needs to be addressed. You're not, whatever, picking up your cleaning up around the house the way that we agreed to. And how that conversation is going to go becomes a crucial element. When I came across this concept, I found it just an amazing insight into the way that we function in our day-to-day activities, in terms of the roles that we play, in terms of the way that conversations develop. And this is a key element. The rest of tonight is going to be focused on that concept as to how do we manage those conversations when they hit. This book was not written for marriage. It's written for, in a business perspective, as to how should a manager, how should a colleague, a boss, how do you handle those conversations? And I am going to borrow heavily from it and apply it into the marriage realm because of how often it happens. Now, why does this happen so often in marriage? So this goes back to the concept that we started addressing last week from this other book that I brought just to show you called Hold Me Tight. This was a book by Sue Johnson, which discusses the attachment theory in terms of how attached we are to our spouses. We are so invested in our marriages. We are so invested in our spouses. I was joking with somebody on the way in. Dragged himself out. He wasn't sure he was going to come. So $18, imagine, amazing what it'll do. You pay $18 and I'm not going to miss it. Now, part of the reason why institutions charge, even though they're nominal fees for such programs, is in order that everybody who shells out, even though it's a nominal fee, you become invested. And when you become invested, you expect something from the program, because if you pay nothing for it, you're not sure you're going to get anything out of it. When you're invested in it, there's a higher expectation of what there is to get out of it, and I will put forth more of an effort in order to make sure that I make it. There is nothing that we are more invested in than our marriages. Nothing. Whether we acknowledge it or not, that's the thesis of that other book which we began addressing last week. There is nothing that we're more invested in. We are so emotionally tied into our marriages and our relationships and what it gives to us and what we give into it that things become highly charged very fast. Conversations which would happen at with our colleagues at work would never become as charged as they become as quickly as they do in our home life. And that's the reality of the relationship, the nature of how tied into each other we are, how much we depend on each other, how much we need each other for support and other things. And that's why we end up in these, what we'll call these crucial conversations, very, very quickly. So how do we navigate them will impact much of our daily lives. Okay, let us begin. Let us begin. Okay. So what I want to do is just address two broad strokes tonight. That's the goal tonight. Two broad strokes. I am not going to pretend that I'm an expert in any of these, nor am I pretend that you're going to walk out of here as experts, but you will have terminology, I hope, and an ability to recognize circumstances as they come up, and you'll be able to handle them far, far better, I hope. Number one, the most critical component when we hit these conversations in which issues need to be addressed. They have to be tackled. There's a touchy situation which comes up all the time in our everyday married life, and now we need it to address them. The critical factor, the one thing that you have to walk out of here is the word dialogue. Simple word, obvious. Dialogue means we're going to be talking about it, right? So obviously if there's a critical conversation that has to take place and there's going to be an issue that needs to be addressed, of course there has to be dialogue. What do I mean when I say dialogue? Dialogue, as we'll define it tonight, is the free flowing of information from both sides. Sounds simple, but if you'll think about your relationships, when you get into those touchy situations, how often you will not share what it is that you're really thinking, or what you're really feeling, or what you're really embarrassed about, or what you're scared about. If you remember, we talked about the cholent last week. So I have a situation. I don't like the cholent. My wife asks me, how's the cholent? Now that should be an innocuous conversation. And what am I afraid of? I'm afraid of this is going to be a problem. So I don't say what I'm really thinking. Everyday occurrence. Well, when the stakes get higher and the situation is much more significant, if I am not able to share what it is that I'm thinking, what it is that I'm feeling, then the conversation can't go anywhere by definition, because we're not dealing with all the information. Imagine a boss, let's start from the business world. You have a boss who's deciding, convening a meeting amongst his employees, whether or not they're going to move the location of the main office. Now the boss has an agenda. He wants the office closer to his home. And as the conversation begins, the boss begins to forcefully position himself that he thinks that everybody should move. And as he's doing so in a way that everybody else gets clear, don't mess with the boss. This is what he wants to do, and he's not taking other opinions. He's shooting them down, he's not giving them the chance to speak, he's not giving them the ability to express themselves. What's going to happen when the decision is made to move? In the business meeting, and everybody's there, and everybody decided.
Resumes go out.
Right? Why?
Because they didn't have a part in it.
Right, they didn't have a part in it. And they're either going to resent it, or they're not going to go along with it, or there's going to be a lot of muttering under breath. But there was a meeting. So this is a very simple example. Yeah, sure there was a meeting, but was this a real meeting? No, it wasn't a real meeting, because the boss was clear, he was forceful, and he wasn't open to accepting other people's opinions. So when the decision was made, it was really a one-sided decision, which everybody else is forced, because of their position, they're just employees, they have to go along with it. And what that creates is a lot of resentment. When that happens in a marriage, in which there's a discussion taking place, the key factor is that there's dialogue. Now, we will recognize in ourselves when we're not really sharing. Imagine you're trying to figure out where to go for Pesach. Pesach comes up, where are we going to go? We have an issue. Who do we go to this year? Do we stay home? Do we make Pesach? Do we go to the in-laws? Do we go to the parents? We're having this conversation. And the way that the conversation is going, the missus in the family simply knows that all of her siblings, her sisters, are going to be at her parents' house. And she just misses them. She just wants to hang out with her siblings. But the way the conversation is going, it's all about other factors. And for whatever reason, which is relevant to us right now, she's not able to share that piece of information. That would really, I really just want to spend Yontiv with my sisters. And that little factor, just I'm taking a simple, innocuous kind of example, but I can't share that. For whatever reason, I'm embarrassed to share that. So whenever the decision's going to be made, the decision's being made missing a critical factor in the equation. There is something that's important to one of the two parties, and they weren't able to express it for whatever reason. And if you can't express it, if we have it on mind, then I'm imagining you're all aware of what I'm talking about, that you're having a conversation and you're just not sharing what you're really thinking. Well, when we don't share what we're really thinking, then by definition, what comes out, the decision that's made, is incomplete. And one of the two parties is not really going to be happy. And eventually what happens when one of the two parties is not happy, the other party's not going to be happy. That's for sure what's going to happen. Eventually it's going to come out, because when we made the decision, there was not a free-flowing of information. Now, in order for there to be free-flowing information, that includes that there has to be the ability, the comfort, to share thoughts which are sensitive, which are controversial, which might just be flat-out wrong. Believe it or not. But I have to be able to share it. And if I can't, then this, which is by definition a crucial conversation, is not going to be going anywhere. Now, that's point A. That's very simple. Simple in words. The question is going to be addressing it. But that's something to be, from what I want you to what I'm, what the idea to be left with is the concept that when you catch yourself, within yourself, in a conversation, and you know it's one of those types of conversations, stakes are high, emotions are running, and you're not sharing yourself. You're not expressing what you really think. You're not expressing how you feel, whether or not your spouse knows it or not. But if you know it, then there has to be something put into place to stop that process from going forward, because it's not going to work. And a relationship has to be built on the ability to share that information, on developing the skills to be able to share it in a way that you're comfortable doing so. Which leads us to part two, the other very simple one word, which is then we'll spend some time trying to address. What is the main issue that prevents a person from being able, or what's the main thing that needs to be there? What word would we describe to be able to freely share all of your thoughts, wishes, dreams, concerns?
Trust.
Good. What else?
A person going to be accepted.
Okay. Trust someone who's going to be accepting.
They say, well, this is nonsense. This is not a good reason. It's denial. Pure denial.
Excellent. So trust, acceptance.
Concentration. All other things that get in the mix and keep you from having a good conversation are muted.
Okay.
Space.
Space, meaning?
Just
just emptiness where you can say that.
Where you, oh, a space into which you can say. So they use a term like the shared pool of information, that there's a place where I can put it,
right,
and they'll be able to dialogue about it. Excellent. So we have like trust, space, acceptance, security, attention.
Safety,
excellent. So I would summarize all of those ideas into safety. If there's safety, then I can share. If there's a lack of safety, if I'm not safe, and this could be in a healthy marriage, but there are conversations within a healthy marriage where I am not feeling safe that I can share this opinion, because it's about your mother. And I don't know how to say it in a way that I can actually share what I'm thinking, and so therefore what ends up happening is it stays in me, and we end up doing things which I never really wanted to do and I agreed upon, and we end up with lots of problems because I wasn't safe to share whatever it was that I needed to share. So the two main concepts, and then that's basically it. It's really all comes down to that. In order, when you hit those conversations, there has to be a concept of dialogue, in which we're able to share and express thoughts, feelings, and emotions. And in order to do so, both parties have to feel safe. When there's a threat to that, it won't happen, and then the conversation won't accomplish whatever it is that it needs to accomplish. Simple enough? Nothing novel, makes a lot of sense. But wait till you get into those situations where you have to deal with it, then it gets a little bit more complicated. Okay, let's start with trying to address a little bit about this. I'll do first as a brief activity. I'm going to introduce it as follows. This might be the most important conversation that you'll ever have. A good introduction? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the last point you just made, how do you have an environment where you feel safe?
Excellent. That's the rest of the night. Trying to create. In other words, I don't feel physically threatened,
right,
but in this relationship, I don't feel safe that I can actually share my thoughts about this particular issue, and then the conversation won't go anywhere. So that's this is what we need to address. It's not novel, but it's critical to be aware and that everyone's on the same terminology, the same page. This is what we want to address, that we can share freely, and that we both need to feel safe in order to be able to do so. Safe and secure.
When you talk about feeling safe, what you're really saying is, I need to know that you're not going to basically come at it with a ton of bricks for expecting.
That's going to be a major component, 100%. In other words, there'll be many components to what will take away from our safety. One of them is, if I think that if I say something that you disagree with, you're going to hammer me, then I won't say certain things because I have a fear of getting hammered. And in a relationship in which I'm afraid of saying certain things because I'm going to get hammered, I won't say them. And then we'll run into problems all the time because I'm careful about what I say. So that's the question. How do you build that environment where conversations can take place and I don't have... Okay, so within a marriage, I want to focus again on the main thing that takes us away from our safety, and then we'll talk about some details that do. So there's an umbrella concept and then some details. And I'd like to introduce it with the following thoughts, and then the conversation that you'll have amongst yourselves will be whether or not you agree or disagree. Here's my assessment. I heard this from those pink sheets, if you had those, there were a bunch of needs. I need this, I need that. It's conversation starters that couples should be able to have. There are two in there which I believe are... I actually brought a bunch in here. If anyone just wants to take a look at them. I believe there are two in here that are the fundamental needs. One for a man and one for a woman. Okay, I believe that the two fundamental needs that are on here, one is I need to feel appreciated more. And the other one is, I need to feel respected by you. Here goes. Here's my assessment. This is based on something I heard. I'd love to give credit to whom I heard this from, and I can't remember which Rav I was listening to, a Shir on Shalom Bayis, and he said this, and it struck me, and I've just been playing with it and adapting it. It goes as follows. Man was created out of nothing. Adam HaRishon, the first man ever created, was created out of nothing. He was dust of the earth. He didn't exist. And out of nothing, God creates man. And because man was created out of nothing, the DNA, the genetic DNA, the spiritual DNA which was embedded in his being is a primal fear of actually being nothing. It's a concern. It's man is concerned with, I am nothing. I am not good. I am not accomplished. I am not successful. It is a drive. It is a fear within man. And what he looks to in his spouse is that feeling of respect. That he is respected, that he's accomplished, that his wife looks to him and says, you are the most amazing thing I've ever met. Now, I'm gonna do all the talking because you guys are embarrassed to say these things, but I'm going to say them so then you can either just say when you have your little conversations with you, agree that yes or no, but I'll do all the embarrassing talking because you will never have this conversation because it's too embarrassing to say, but I'll say it for you. A man looks to his wife to fulfill that sense that says, you are unbelievable. You're amazing. I respect everything about you. I think you are accomplished, successful, and that is a primal need that a man has because he was born out of nothing. He is a fear that he is nothing. And what he looks for in his spouse more than anything else, what he yearns for, desires, is the sense that his wife gives him that, I do respect you and I do think that you're unbelievable. Woman, Chava, was not created out of nothing. She was created out of something that already existed. She was created out of Adam. She doesn't have any fear that she's a nothing. But what was her primal task that she was created for? To be an Ezer Kenegdo, to be a completion, to be a help. And her primal fear is, all this that I'm doing, that I'm putting in, you don't appreciate it. You don't realize what I'm doing. So it's not a feeling of nothingness, but it's a feeling of being underappreciated. And so that a woman's primal need that she needs from her husband is not to say that you're successful, not that you're amazing in that sense, but that I recognize and appreciate all the things that you're doing. And it is a very deep need that a woman has to feel appreciated, as deep as it is the husband's need to feel respected. Now I use the words respect and appreciate. They're different words, and I'm trying to paint a picture. That's my thesis. Now the problem with this is because men feel the need for respect, they're weak on giving appreciation because that's not the world they function in. They're not dealing with appreciation, they're dealing with, I'm out there, I'm hunting, I'm successful in doing things. Whereas the woman who's dealing in the realm of being appreciated isn't realizing how much her husband needs to be felt, to be made to feel respected. That's always the primal issue. That's my thesis. My questions for you, and this is going to be our starting point as to what creates the fear in the lack of safety. This will be our starting point. I give you a couple minutes on your own. You could, this is how we'll set it up. You could simply, on a scale of 1 to 10, agree or disagree with what I'm saying on each thing. In other words, husbands, talk to your wives and say, a 10, I totally agree with him. My greatest need from you, what I yearn for, even though I might not have ever expressed this before in our married lives, tonight, for $18, you could have spent hundreds on counseling. For $18. We might never have had this conversation because it's a weird conversation to kind of have. It's an uncomfortable conversation, but I'm doing it for you. All you need to say is 10. I agree completely, and your wife will hear from you that your greatest yearning and need is to be respected. Or you can say, yeah, it's a nice thesis. I give it an 8 or a 6. And wives can turn to your husbands and say, 10. I totally agree with him. It's appreciation. I need that from you more than anything else. If it's not a 10, if you think it's less than an 8, so come up with something else that it is. Maybe it's pride, that you're proud, or that it's reversed. Maybe a husband really feels more, he needs appreciation more than respect. Maybe a wife feels that she needs respect more than appreciation. Whatever it is. But I'm giving you, that's my thesis, and I give you a few minutes to have this critical conversation, which you'll do in 2 minutes, and now you'll know forever that you will hear from your husband 10, I'm right, or maybe 9, 8, 7, I don't have to hear you do it, speak amongst yourselves for 2 minutes. Okay, so now that you've had 2 minutes to discuss this most critical of topics, and you're on the same page, and you both know what each other needs and yearns from you more than anything else, we can move on. Now, why is this significant? Let's say, I don't know, you don't have to tell me what you guys thought, if I was right or if I was wrong, if it was a perfect 10 or a 9 or an 8, but I'm pretty sure that it's critical on both sides. That I feel very confident about, that the need for respect, the need for appreciation is up there. One of the greatest threats to... Everyone, this is, it's too important a conversation. I don't want to disturb. What's that? Okay, we're going to go on. I know you're in the middle of heated discussions, but we're going to go on anyway. One of the greatest threats to our safety in being able to have conversations is when either of those two are touched. Because our relationship in marriage is so critical and it touches us so deeply, and our need from the relationship is so great in the form of either respect and or appreciation, when a conversation goes off in a way in which either one of those are even slightly touched or off, we get very, very defensive, and we're put on the defensive because of the fact that this is what I need from out of the relationship, and when I'm sensing that this relationship is going in a way in which I'm not being respected or appreciated or both, so then that's one of the first factors to look at in general in a relationship. Not even the specific conversation. In the relationship in general, when that's taking place, you can be assured that conversations will not go smoothly when that is not in place. And it's worth noting, and the reason why I just want to start with that, even though it's not a specific tool for these conversations, is recognizing how important it is in a safety in a marriage in general to have that which is so critical, whether or not it's a 10 or not. The concept of respect and appreciation is one of the greatest positions of safety that we have. When it's not there, it's usually the kind of thing that touches so deep, whichever spouse is not feeling it on whatever level that they feel like they need it, that they can't even express it. I can't say, I don't feel respected enough. It's too sensitive to be able to say it. But when I need to be able to say it, or that's what I'm feeling, it will come out in a lot of different areas in the terms of the safety of the whole relationship, because it's such a critical issue, it's so hard to talk about, so sensitive, yet so critical to creating a general atmosphere of safety. All right, let's start with some basic threats. What are the threats that we would have? Some of you mentioned already. Let's just put them out on the table. What are the threats we're going to have? A conversation begins. We're talking about Pesach. Where should we go? What are we going to do? So let's just throw out some threats to our position of safety. Let me start off with the cute one. They have a name for this in one of the books that I changed the name for my own sake. We're going to call it the Fool's Choice. What is the Fool's Choice? Which is a great way to end a conversation. I'll give you an example. Someone actually just told me. Let's go back to the example that we started with last week. The way that I positioned it. Wife puts cholent out on the table on Shabbos afternoon. She put honey in it. Big mistake. Honey's not supposed to go in cholent. You taste it. Terrible. You manage a couple bites. She asks, how was it? Now, when I threw out this question last week, and I said, what was the problem? Most of you got the problem, right? What's the problem? What are my two options? Either I say, it's great, delicious, honey. And then what am I stuck with?
Honey in the
cholent forever. Or I say, that was terrible. And what am I afraid of? There's going to be some horrible blow-up. In my head, when I have those two choices, I've really created what we'll call a fool's trap, or a fool's choice. What's the trap in that equation? Right. I created only two options. It's either in my head, I'm thinking like, what should I do? Either I say the truth and get blasted, or I lie and I get stuck with honey in my children for the rest of my life. If I think of it in that way, I'm stuck because I don't have a good answer. But it's a trap, because who forced those two options on me? I did. I made up those two options. I determined that it's either going to be I'm going to say it in a way that's going to get me blasted, or I'm going to end up with honey. Those aren't the only two options. There are lots of other options, except if you create a situation in which you do that. Now, do we do that in our heads? We sometimes do that actually verbally. For example, someone told me recently that there was a rav in a shul who sent his kid to a school that was not aligned with the shul. That makes sense? Whatever the shul was, we'll leave out which part of the spectrum it was. And this rav sent his kid to a school not following the party lines of where the shul was. And the president marches in and says, you can't possibly be a rav for our shul. If you were to send your kid to such a school, you're clearly not
one of us.
Either you go or I go.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, it sounds ridiculous. Except we actually do this all the time in other ways that are not so drastic. But what's the trap? What's the fool's trap with that opening line when he walks into the Rav's office? He created two options. It's either you go or I go. When really, what needs to happen here?
You need to work in a dialogue.
All right, like what's the deal? What's with the child? There's a thousand reasons that could be going on. Right? So, but we actually now, the reason why you bring like silly examples like that, it's like, well, who would do something like that? Well, we actually do things like this all the time when we decide like where we're going for Pesach and we say, okay, here are our choices. It's either a disaster at your mom or a disaster at my mom. Which one should we do? Or if we, right? So we actually create scenarios that inhibit the dialogue from the very beginning as to how should we work it out, because we actually verbalize two options. Like, let's say a husband misses an anniversary. So his wife can say to him, you know, I don't know what it is. Either you're the biggest buffoon that's ever lived on the face of the planet, or you don't love me. And she would obviously be saying that with a lot more emotion and a lot more feeling. But what do you mean? Why are those only two options? Maybe I actually forgot. Like, maybe that's a possibility. Maybe it's not. I don't know. That would, so, I don't know. Would it? So it wouldn't, because, the problem is, when you present it that way, right, you've actually, now there's no way back from that. So it's worth noting that sometimes we do it verbally. We actually present two options, and then there's no dialogue because it's, you can't have creative thinking when you're stuck between two choices. What I want to point out more is that we do it in our own heads. In our own heads, we create scenarios in which we don't allow options because we've painted one of two possible pictures. It's either going to be this or it's going to be that. And then it's hard to get creative juices flowing when you're sort of limited and trapped into your possibilities as to what you're going to be thinking about. Okay, but what are some other threats that we have to our safety? The reason why I started with that, it's a threat to our safety when I feel like I don't have any choices because it's already been like laid out like this, and then we sort of get trapped in the discussion between those two choices without actually being able to share. What are some other threats, major threats to our safety, to be able to actually share information when we get involved in the discussion? You had one earlier. What are the threats to our ability to...
Being accepted?
No, so being accepted, so being hammered. I'm afraid I'm going to get hammered.
I don't want to hurt you.
Or we don't want to hurt our spouse. I'm afraid that if I actually say the truth, if I actually tell you how crazy I think your mother is, then I'm going to hurt you. So I don't say it. Okay, fine. Now that I'm not saying it, that's not out there. Excellent. So I'm afraid of hurting, afraid of getting hammered.
It becomes sticky, whereas the spouse will continue to use that line or not forget that line, and it becomes a permanent fixture.
Part of the comment. It's not part of the permanent dialogue is that I once said X,
right,
and now it's always
and
going to be...
You can't ever get that back.
Okay, good. How about sarcasm? If I have any fear that if I'm going to say something, it's going to be met with sarcasm, or it actually is met with sarcasm. What happens to the dialogue once sarcasm is entered in? Completely over. Conversation's over. Contempt. If I throw out a suggestion, oh, give me a break. If you throw one of those out into a conversation is over. Now, it might actually continue verbally, but the conversation's over. Yeah, you don't like what I'm saying.
This is your poverty attempt.
Okay.
You know, and it's taken the wrong
path. Fine. Excellent. In other words, sometimes that would be like what we said, a repair attempt. And I was like, the conversation's getting too heated, and I want to try to loosen it up, and that's absolutely fine. I'm referring to the kind where I didn't mean that, and it was taken the way that I meant it, in the sense of, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Which, if you believe it or not, is actually said in conversations that people who pretend to love each other actually say to each other. But then it's over. Conversation's done. It's finished because I can't actually say what I'm thinking. The reason why I said that is because I actually probably felt it. And what did I get back? Well, that's the silliest, most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Well, okay, so I'm not going to be sharing any more opinions in this matter because it's not taken well. So when that happens, note, I don't have the solutions yet, but note that there's going to have to be a break, a backpedaling, and a starting again, because the conversation as it is can't go on. Yeah, you have a question?
No, it was just another one. Of
yeah.
Another threat. Because what you just described is you actually say what you mean to say the way you mean to say it, and you get contempt or pushback, whatever.
Right.
What about the fear of it's going to come out wrong? No matter what I,
in other words, excellent.
What I want to say, I just know that I'm not going to be able to. I'm going to step all over myself. And come out
good. So you know, I don't have the skill to be able to say it, and I'm afraid that my spouse receiving it is not going to help me out, throwing me the line or giving me the patience to try to get out what it is that I actually a want to get out.
Like stage fright.
Yes. Those are all things. Yeah.
A person could also fear being ignored. If a person,
right,
not that they'll get hammered, but they allow themselves to become sensitive and ask for something, and they will.
So, 100%. The fear of being ignored, so the fear of being hammered, the fear of not being respected, the fear of receiving sarcasm, or actually getting sarcasm, contempt, any of those things will put an end, in effect, to the conversation at hand. How do we know when a conversation has ended? This is the next critical thing that I'll ask you to figure out amongst yourselves. There are two major ways, there are lots of ways, in which you could pick up from your spouse that, like, we went off somewhere along the way. There are two major ways. Men and women generally do these different, but not always, and I wouldn't want to peg anyone by forcing them into anyone. But one would be what we would call stonewalling, which is John Gottman's term, which basically is you become a silent wall. You completely retreat into yourself and into your little shell, and there ain't nobody who can get you out, particularly your spouse. And the more that, mostly men do this much more than women, but women do it just as well, in which the hurt is so bad, the suffering, the pain, the fear, whatever it is, I just shut down, and there's just this cold silence in the house because I'm not talking, I'm not interacting, and I'm not. And the more that you try to get me out, the more that I'm going in. And so the one who's left on the outside doesn't like being on the outside because they have that primal fear of the threat. The relationship's in danger. They're noticing that. And what's the problem with the relationship? You're in your shell. Well, how do I fix this? I got to get you out of your shell. So the more that I prod and plug and kick and bang on the shell, the more you say, I don't want this, I don't need this, and I can't handle this. And you just go farther and farther and farther in until you finally feel like you have some space to slowly crawl back out again. That's one major response to a failed either relationship as a whole, where it's going, where something happened, or a conversation didn't go well. Well, all of a sudden, like in the middle of the conversation, all of a sudden, like it just like it like stopped. Like we're in the middle of this conversation, and I was getting really into it, and all of a sudden, like my spouse just like disappeared on me. Like we're like I felt we're in the middle of talking, and they're like they retreated, they're finished, they're done, and you can't get it back out. That's like one major sign that something happened, and they're not feeling safe right now. The other major one is in which you respond. You respond in an attacking way. In other words, you respond with blames. The voices get escalated. In other words, if I feel attacked, I can either retreat into my shell, or I fight back. And all of a sudden, the conversation gets very heated. Those are two very different homes. If you could imagine a fly on the wall watching those two different homes, in one home, there's this like cold silence that suddenly sets in, where one spouse doesn't want to talk anymore. And the other home, there's this escalating tension of voices going higher and higher, each one trying to force their opinion. They're not in their shells. They're in the center of the ring, and they got their gloves on, and they are going at it. Those are two very different approaches, but they're the same thing. They're both senses of, I'm not safe, I'm not comfortable. And how do I respond? Do I either respond by retreating and saying, I just don't want to deal with this? Or do I respond by saying, well, since you're the one making me not safe, you're the one who's threatening me, so I respond to a threat with another threat. If you end up with two people like that, there's going to be a lot of yelling in the house. If you end up with one and one, you end up with one person constantly chuppering the other one, and the other one just going deeper and deeper. And if they're both into their shell kind of people, there's just a lot of silence going on because nobody wants to speak first and everybody's just quiet. So your second little activity is to sort of identify yourselves in your... Now, all of you have done that, and if you haven't done it, you can pretend what it would be like if you could imagine ever being offended by your spouse, how you think you would react. Most people I know actually know very well because they're married for about 2 hours and it happens, in which they respond. That's just the way that it goes. And we have ways in which we respond. So it's an important thing to identify and actually say to each other, I retreat into my shell. That's what happens. When I feel unsafe, when I feel threatened, when I feel uncomfortable, that's just what I do. I'm not giving solutions how to get the person out, but just to recognize versus, no, I don't do that. When I get uneasy, I feel like I go on the offensive. And it's important to see in each other and to be able to identify that so that when it happens, you're in a much better place to say, whoa, remember I went to that workshop, you're that guy, I'm this one, let's just and we can scale back, which will be our next step. But that, take a second, and if you're comfortable doing so, to identify your primary means of what happens when you are offended or unsafe in your marriage. Are you more the kind of person who's going to be a retreat kind of person, or the kind of person who's going to fight back and attack? You take a second, it's usually not a long thing, but just worth sharing with each other. All right, let's move on. All right, what I want to just touch on a little bit is some tools that I got out of this, out of either the books or other places, just to sort of, so how do we navigate it? So let's take an example, pulling one out of the sheet. I need to spend more time working on our parenting. So one of the two spouses, husband or wife, you know, dealing with their situation at home, and they realize, you know, we need to spend more time on this. It's just, I see, we're not perfect, we're making mistakes, I need to spend more time on it. Now, that's going to be a touchy situation, because what is the gut reaction that the spouse hearing that is going to assume you mean? Correct. You're being a lousy parent. Which, in effect, you are saying, but you don't mean to say it in an offensive way. You mean to say it as, like, hey, like, raising kids are hard. It's not an easy thing to do. We've been busy with our lives. We haven't spent a lot of time in it, and we need to spend some time on it. Except this is going to be this will very easily turn into what we'll call a crucial conversation, because the stakes are going to get very high and emotions are going to run very high very quickly when you mention over the dinner table, you know, I really think we need to be working on our parenting more. Because what you are saying is, we're not doing a great job. Or we could be doing a better job, let's say it in a softer way. We could be doing a better job. So as an example, so you want to bring up the conversation. So you go over your notes from last week and you say, okay, the first thing that needs to do is we need to have a soft startup. I don't want to just sort of mention that, like, right after my husband yells at the kids for not getting in the bath. That's not a good time to say, you know what, we really need to be working on our parenting. That's not going to go over well, because every husband's going to make the connection of, I see, that's what, so that's not going to work. So it's going to be the kind of thing, you have a nice soft setup, startup, you're going to say, you know, I think maybe you have a time, wanted to talk about something which you think is very important, do you have any time later, fine, you sit down on the couch with a cup of coffee. I think it'd be good if we'd work on our parenting, some of our parenting skills together. And you get the response that you were afraid of, you get something along the lines of, wait, you think I'm not a good parent? Or something along those lines, and however your spouse would respond in an inappropriate way. Now, of course, the perfect spouse would say, absolutely, you're right, I was thinking the same thing. But that doesn't always, life doesn't always go that way. And let's assume you get that, not such a great response. What are some of the tools that we can use as far as allowing the dialogue to take place, that we can actually figure out, there's a conversation that has to happen here. There's a conversation that has to happen. It's not going to be simple. It's going to be uncomfortable, because by definition, the issue at hand is we're not doing a great job, and I think we need to be doing better, and clearly the fact that you haven't brought this up means you're probably okay with the way that it is now, but I'm not. So it's going to be touchy. It's not going to be the most touchy on this list, but it can be a touchy situation. Or if you want to choose a different example, wife says to her husband, I think I need our Shabbos table to be more relaxed or more spiritual. Now that's a need that this is what I picture the Shabbos table being, and I'm doing my end of the bargaining, I'm putting out all the food, and I need you to be better prepared with Dvar Torah, Zmir, whatever it may be, engaging the children, you name it. It's going to be another uncomfortable situation, because by definition, what I'm saying is, it's not right the way it is now, and I have in my mind the way that I think it should be, and we need to get from where it is now to the way that I'd like it to be. It's going to be a touchy situation. It's going to be an uncomfortable situation. Yeah.
The problem seems to be, it's not just the fact that we're being told that we're doing a lousy job. It's because we thought we were doing a good job.
Excellent, right? I thought my Shabbos table was extremely spiritual and very engaging. Right. And all of a sudden I hear from my wife, you know, I really think we should try to make our Shabbos table more engaging, right? That is going, it's going, now, what are her choices? She could say, well, I'm not going to say anything, and then she's going to be miserable for the next 20 years. So it's a fair conversation to have, right? This is what I'd like. I'd like for our Shabbos table to look like this, and yet it's going to be a very uncomfortable situation when you bring that up. There's just no way around it. It's going to be touchy. It's going to be sensitive. Right, so she does the right thing, and I saw a startup, we have a conversation, we can talk a little bit later, we sit down, we talk, and you say, you know, I really think that we need to work on our parenting, I really think that our Shabbos table would benefit from being a little bit more spiritual. And you get the response of, whatever, a negative response. So what are some of the skills that would go into trying to be able to guide this conversation into the place where it needs to go, where it can be a conversation, be a dialogue, and some type of results can come out? So number one is staying focused on what it is that you want. What do you want? If you go into a conversation, you introduce what's going to be a sticky type of conversation, a crucial conversation, and you're not sure what it is that you want, then it's going to go off in a lot of different directions, and you're going to have a hard time keeping it focused on where it is that it needs to be. In this situation, when you say, we need to work on our parenting, what do you want? What do you want when you say you want your Shabbos table to be a little bit more spiritual? So that we can talk about it in the concrete kind of way. The conversation has a way to continue in the sense of, is it Zmiros? Is it more guests? Is it less guests? Is it engaging the children? Is it more Divrei Torah? What do you want it to have? What is it about working on our parenting, taking classes, reading books? What do we want to be able to have? Sometimes we throw things out there and it's very vague in terms of what it is that we even want to be able to have. If we stay focused on what it is that we want, we're able to... One of the things that you need to have, when you think about when we've received criticism, this would be in terms of... Most of the time when we receive criticism, what is our immediate response when we receive criticism?
Defensive.
Correct. We are defensive. Why are we defensive when we receive criticism? That is important. Like, why is that? The person who's criticizing us, are they usually right or wrong in their criticisms?
Right.
So my personal experience has been they're almost always right. Whatever it is that anyone is telling me, it's almost always correct. Whatever it is that they're pointing out that I'm not doing right, they're right. I'm not doing right, then I can do better. Yet, almost every single time anyone is pointing anything out to me, my initial gut response is being very defensive. Ego. So why is that?
It's a front.
Okay,
it's
so front. Ego, front.
It's an upfront to them.
Oh, it's an upfront, meaning because I'm being offended that you're actually pointing something out.
So you're damaging like their honor, their...
Excellent. You're damaging my self-image, my honor. Excellent. What else? Yeah?
My survival is threatened.
Your survival is threatened because you're saying that I'm no good and whatever it is that I'm... Excellent. Anything else? Have you ever received criticism from someone and you took it well? If you could think about such a situation. What was different about that scenario? What was there that allowed you to receive the criticism?
Knowing that this person was contributing to me.
Excellent. So if I know that the person is actually contributing, yeah, what were you going to say? I'm too late. You started saying it. You have to finish it. Okay, Natalie. Yeah. What's that? Meaning when you're in a environment where that's what we're doing here is we're working on ourselves.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Why does that work? In other words, when we get into a musarvad, group of people get together, they study their own character development, and someone in that context says this, why is it that we're able to accept that better?
Because we've all like agreed on the rules, and it's like a very accepting environment, and we all feel safe.
Right? When we've agreed on the rules, like that's what we're doing here. We all have problems. Maybe you all have the same problem. That's why we're all working on this together. All of a sudden there, when you point out that you're not doing this well, that's not nearly as offensive as when my spouse points it out to me. Because these are the rules. That's what we're doing here.
The future of the prior, this is not the beginning of the conversation, but this is maybe the middle part. And prior to that, maybe there's got the lesson. People personally agree and compliment and something else prior to that. It's about... to make it even better, you know, or something to use it roses before the spike.
Okay, if it's true, the problem with that is if I have something to say and I'm just trying to sugarcoat it to make it less painful, then usually the compliment comes out and is not received well. I don't like when someone says to me, you know, you're really a great speaker, but you speak too long. So I don't even hear the first part because you're only saying that because you want to get to the part that you want to say. So why are you doing that? I don't buy that.
No, sincere and skillful.
Right. So I'm saying that's I'm saying to be careful. We're all on guard when someone says something nice and then there's a but, and we all know that means disregard whatever they said. They were just trying to get to the but, and they felt bad starting with that, so they said something nice and then they got to the but. So you're right if it's done well, but it's dangerous because do I feel better or worse when someone starts off when they have a criticism and they start off with that? It doesn't make me feel any better. I just don't buy it. Whatever it is that they were saying. So if it's done well, yes, but I'm just careful. Are you about to do
your... No, if you're like, if you're paying for a critique, if you're paying for someone to look at your work, someone to review your... Like, if you're paying for something, and you're asking for them to critique it.
All right, similar to, like, these are the rules of the game, and here you've actually asked for it. Yeah.
I was talking about paying somebody to give you, you know.
Yeah, I'm...
Therapy,
yeah. Do you
want to say? I was going to say that, you know, people in a work, for example, oftentimes, like, with an assistant, I'll say, you know, my door's open, so let's say something, you know, things get heated in the day, things get busy, and somehow, like, I put out that if I offended you, or, you know, that you can come in and have a conversation, so... I'm welcoming.
Are you invited to conversation? Excellent. No, excellent. These are all great, yeah.
I think the approach is important, because there's a big difference between constructive criticism among someone you trust and someone attacking you. You know, the honey the tulip thing, like if you were to say, when you're asked to say, how do you like it? Say, well, you could say it was I really prefer it when it's this way, or you know, I really like it with just me and this and this and this and potatoes are correct, and I really like the way you did it before.
Right, there's a way that you speak it out.
Without it being so critical, without saying I hate it, or you always mess it up.
So yeah.
One more thing. When you said 99% of the time, probably it's true what people are saying.
It's 100%.
99%. 100%.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll say 99% of the time.
For me, I'm saying for you personally.
Okay. 99% of the time, it's either not for that person to be telling you, or they're saying you instead of I feel. They're doing it. It's in an inappropriate.
Okay, good.
Context. It's not for them to be doing it.
So, and when you put all these things together, which are all excellent responses, and they're all true, and the reason why you're saying that is because we've all experienced receiving criticisms in a way, which is really it's this tremendous dichotomy in the sense of it's a contradiction. If the criticisms are true, who stands to gain when we hear them? We do, and yet we just don't take it well. Which is a very tight wire, like I really need it. I won't get better if you don't share this with me, and yet I want to bite your head off when you tell it to me. So I do bite your head off, and then I go back and work on whatever it is you told me because I know that it's true. So it's like so in a marriage it doesn't work well if I bite your head off and then say and then go work on it, but you're left without your head. So and you don't really appreciate that, and you're not going to be quick to say it again the next time, even though I need to hear it the next time, and really this is how the relationship works. If you put it into practice, the simple words, difficult to create, but mutual respect and mutual purpose. So what that would mean is, if, as you said, I think it was Jen who said it, like when you have my best interest in mind, and I stand to gain, you stand to gain. If you can convince me, the reason why you're saying this is because...
Contribution.
It's a contribution to me. Or when you talk about the children, in other words, we need to work on our parenting. If that comes off as, you need to work on your parenting, even though I might have used the word we, but if what comes out is, you need to work on your parenting, so then it's going to be much harder to hear than if there's a mutual... purpose of these are our children, and it's an honest comment. Like I can hear it better if it's actually we need to be working on this because we do. Because yeah.
So whose responsibility is it for the speaker to make sure that when they communicate they say we and they mean we and it comes out as we, or for the listener? To hear we and understand we and perceive we, you know what I mean?
It's all in your husband. You're right. I know. I got it. Did I not say that clearly enough? The reason why I only do this the reason why I think it should be done this way that both spouses are there is because if you're on the same page, you can address it. It can like. Even you could say like 5 months from now, 6 months from now, like wait a minute. There's a dialogue that you can have that puts you back on the same page in the sense of I'm not feeling safe. You could talk that way, but it's on the speaker's head when he's speaking or she's speaking to actually say it in the right way. And so, but it's on the listener also to give a little leeway with that. But it's certainly primarily on, I would say on the speaker. So what happens is, so you're trying to do well and it doesn't come out well. You're trying to create a safe environment where there's a respect. If there's not a respect, it won't come out. If it comes out condescending, if it comes out with contempt, you can forget it. But if you're able to create, in a sense, with respect, that shared value, yeah, it sometimes doesn't always work. So what one skill that I saw in one of these books that I just want to show two more things, and I'll let you go. One is a concept in which you mess up. It didn't go well. There was a blow up. The conversation is going in the wrong direction. To be able to step back and apologize, and then do what these authors call contrasting. Now, what they mean by contrasting is defining what it is that you meant. So often we say things, and they're interpreted in ways that we didn't mean them. They're interpreted much larger. Let's say, for example, in the case of the parenting. Let's say I'm the one who says to my wife, I think we really need to be working on our parenting. And I mean it absolutely, completely, honestly, in the sense of, I think we're doing a fine job. Our kids are getting older. They're in a new stage. We've never had a teenager before. I don't know what in the world I'm doing with a teenager. I think we should, let's do something new for teenagers. Like, there's like a whole new world having teenagers. And I mean it in that sense, like, totally. And she takes it in the sense of, that I think she's overworked and she's not patient with the kids and she's messing up. She gets all flustered about the whole thing. So to be able to actually say, no, I don't mean to say, and use those, I don't mean to say X, Y, or Z. I do mean to say A, B, and C. Because what came out was clearly interpreted in one way, and you have to then like scale back and say, no, wait. No, I didn't mean to say that you're impatient, that I think you're too tired, that you have too many jobs, we have too much company. I didn't mean any of that. I just meant we have a teenager now, and we don't know what we're doing with her. So I think just to have the idea that when you see something as a conversation is going off in a direction that you didn't mean for it to go off, and to be able to scale back, take that step back and say, time out, pause, and say, I didn't mean to say this, that's a safety mechanism. In other words, a person who's responding, if my wife were to respond, I'm just making up this example, why is she responding that way? Because she's feeling threatened. That I'm saying that she's not a good parent, that she's overwhelmed and overworked, and so you respond from that perspective of, I don't feel safe. To be able to go back and say, no, I don't mean to say that, whatever you're interpreting what I'm meaning to say, I just mean to be working on this, and that's very comforting for the person who initially hears whatever that's being said, because we like to globalize things when we hear criticisms, and we make them into much bigger things than they really were meant, and to be able for the person who was the speaker to say and to clarify, no, this is what I meant. I didn't mean that. I didn't want to say that. And I'm not sugarcoating things. I'm saying what I want to say. This is what I want to work on, but not necessarily those other things. And another, on that same line, you know, in all things in life, there are facts, and then there are stories which come together with those facts. This is what actually happened. And then we often build stories of meaning around those facts. And life is about that. Life is about interpreting and attributing meaning to events which took place. But the events themselves are just events. They're just things that happened. And one of the key things when these conversations begin is, and this is really what you were speaking about a few minutes ago, of sticking to the facts. Of starting with, this is what happened. I'm left to, and then you can state your story, but not as part of the original equation. This is what took place. We were late to three weddings in a row. That's a fact. The interpretation that you have to that you're incompetent, that you can't get yourself together, that you're unorganized, those are interpretations of the fact that we were late. So you can start with the fact, we were late. There's a kind of, like, I can't stand being late. The last three events that we went to, we were significantly late, drives me crazy. So if I don't say anything, the pattern's going to continue. I can't handle that. So this needs to be addressed. How do we address it? A component would simply be to at least start with the facts. This is what we're going to have this conversation with. We've been late to the past three weddings. That's a fact. You can't argue with that. I'm left to conclude that maybe it'd be better if we went separate, or maybe you have too many things going on. I don't know what to make of it. What do you think? And then presenting with just starting with the facts and allowing the dialogue to continue in terms of, well, this is what I thought, this is what you thought. If I have an opportunity, not where I need to defend myself from your original interpretation, but you just put out the facts, This is what's going on. We have a teenager. I'm noticing that she's speaking back a lot, and I don't know what to do. What do you think we should do with it? As opposed to saying, starting with, we're incompetent parents, you're an incompetent parent, without the interpretation, without the story that we have attached to the facts that are there, but starting with the facts and then allowing the conversation to go from there often is a way to begin to allow the dialogue to take place. Yeah.
So what if you have a tougher example where it's not parenting, where you both can do it? Let's say that his commitment and responsibility is to fix things in the house, right?
Yeah.
And he's not doing it. So what's the way for her to say, you know, come and say, like, stuff in the house is broken and it's not being fixed. It's not us. We don't need to work on this. You made the
right, 100%. Yeah. Right.
So the whole thing about stating facts, okay, like that is the only thing.
Dude, the house is broken.
Like, you know, right. Like, it's a fact. That doesn't seem to be helpful in this scenario. But also saying like you made a commitment and you're not doing it. Like, so what's the good way to approach?
Right. So in other words, you have a situation. Say, you committed to fix the lights. I'm noticing that it's still broken. It hasn't been done yet. I'm left. You can either say I'm left to conclude that you're not going to be able to get it done. Would you like to? I don't know if it's a matter of you're not planning on hiring somebody. You know, you're committed to do it yourself. I'm assuming that's like in that type of situation, in the sense of you're basically coming out to be stating in need of these are the facts. It hasn't been fixed. You committed to fix it, and I need to have them.
So I'm asking, what's a good way to start that conversation? What's the soft start in this conversation? Because I don't see one. Like what you're saying is a start, but it doesn't seem very soft to me.
Right. So a softer start in that would be, you know, can we talk about the? Clearly, this has been a conversation which has taken place a couple times already. That's obviously we're coming in the middle of the story, right? He's committed. He said the light's been broken. I'll fix it. Light's still broken. I'll fix it. Now what do I do? I'm stuck. How many times am I going to bring this up?
Call electrician.
Right? So, and that's one option, but you don't want it, right? So if this were a law and logic class, it would be, you just call an electrician, and then, you know, you figure out where that money's coming from out of something that will affect him and not. But that's not a law and logic class. We'll leave that. So the soft start would be, I'd like to address the light fixture. Which I just had a train of thought which I just lost, sorry. Yeah, I'd like to talk about the light fixture. I don't want to be a nag, but we've spoken about this two or three times already. When can I expect to have that completed by?
Oh, it's an awkward,
you know,
that's exactly the way you do it. That's how you just bring integrity into it.
No, I mean, I'm not saying that that's not right. I'm just saying, like, on the receiving end, that doesn't feel like...
Well, you're messing up. How good should you feel if you made a commitment, you're not keeping it? This is where these conversations are tough. In other words, you made a commitment, you didn't keep it. She asked you again, made a commitment, you didn't keep it. So what should happen? How good should you feel?
So when you had kids, you also made a commitment to, be a good parent. Maybe it was implicit. But when thinking about bringing up the conversation about being better parenting, mm-hmm. right? Like we think about the soft start, right? Like maybe we even said it three times, but again we say, okay, I think that it would be great to work on our parenting or something like that. That's a soft start.
Mm-hmm.
So here, like it's the same thing, but there's no I don't feel like there's a soft start. It's like that's it.
How about this one? It would be great to have light in the bedroom.
The difference is, what is it need to be done to fix it? Is it matter that you're not finding the time? In other words, what's the problem? Is it you don't have the time, you don't have the skill that you're planning on learning it, you haven't been able to learn it? Why is it not getting fixed? Whatever the example is, in other words, your wife asks you to fix the light, you say, I'll fix it. Is it just a matter of finding the 5 minutes, or is it a matter of I don't really know what I'm doing, I need to learn it, and I haven't been able to get that? Why is it not getting done? Parenting is a matter of we need to go learn. It's like normal that we haven't been able to do this. An example that the way that I'm hearing your example, it's a matter of it's not like a hard thing to do. It's just do it.
Well, our lights are working. Oh, I'm just saying.
You know, it's your friend's life. I know. Yeah.
As an example, there's a lot of stuff, couples have, where there are clear delegations of responsibilities. Mm-hmm. This is my stuff. Right. I'll fix that.
Yeah.
This is your stuff. So what's a good way
to start a conversation where, like, the other person is not like, yeah, like, right. They're just not doing what they said they would do.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear some stuff. Yeah.
So you have in your example, there's a distinction that you're stepping over called integrity. And by integrity, I don't mean morality or ethics. I simply mean doing what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. That's integrity. All right. So if you've told me that you're going to fix the lights, I'm going to say to you, thank you for that promise. By when will you do it? And then you make me a promise. And then if you're going to do what you say when you say you're going to do it, you're going to keep your promise. Or I'm going to call you on it. You promised me you'd do this by 2:00. It didn't happen. Will you make a new promise now? I'm not going to make you wrong for it. I don't know what happened. I don't know what your story is. I still like you. You're still a good person. But your word is out of integrity. That's just a fact. You made a promise to do something by a certain time. You didn't keep it. So it's not going to be a make wrong, like you're a bad person. You simply didn't keep your word. So now I'm giving you an opportunity to put the integrity back in by acknowledging that you didn't keep your word and by making a new promise. And it's just a straight, direct talk. And then the important thing is that I don't make it a make wrong. I'm not going to make you into a bad person because you didn't fix the light. I'm simply, you said you'd do it, and I'm presenting you with your own integrity. Now you put your integrity back in.
Let me just hear from that. Thank you. I just want to get a couple of the things. I don't let people go. I don't want to keep everybody lying. Yeah.
I just wanted to say, I think also that if you can, just to put an emotional piece into it, to say, I'm not saying I'm hurt by this. I'm not saying I'm taking this personally. But I know you've been busy. I know, you know, there's been a lot on your plate. You probably, whether you forgot about it or whether it's just, you know, I just would really, really appreciate, and, you know, like Jen's saying, when do you think you'll be able to get to it? Or would you rather me call somebody else? You know, I'm not making this about, you know, you being doing this to hurt me, or you doing this because you're not trying to care for my needs. I know there's probably good reasons why you haven't and why you know, didn't. But can I count on you for this? Or would you rather me go about finding another way of getting it done?
I'm going to be a little harsher. You mentioned a soft start. Well, I'm sure that the first time a subject like that comes up, it's fairly soft and polite. The second time it's a little bit less soft, it's like new. By the third time, there's already exasperation. So, I mean, if a person has a chronic procrastination problem, that's a whole new, different issue.
Yeah.
I mean, we all have it. You know, some people are passive aggressive, some people, you know, they're not considerate. I mean, if my boss says, I need you to do X, will you do X by tomorrow? I say yes. If I don't do it, there's a consequence. But if my wife asks me, and I forget or I don't do it, you know, so I'll do it next day. You know, it's Hamish. I mean, like Jan said, there's an integrity. Either a word means something or it doesn't. Unfortunately, with all of us, a word is meaningful to some people sometimes and not meaningful with other people other times. And
with all of us?
Yeah.
I will just say, because I am a man and I came from nothing, and my need is to feel approved of and respected by my wife, it will be 10 times more effective if she says something like, it would mean so much to me if you would change that light bulb. That would get me to run and do it, because the payoff is going to be a lot better than the nag, because I feel disapproved of when she's blaming me for not doing it. It would end up, so therefore, all I'm saying is, even when you have a clear delineation of, you know, responsibility, a soft start is always to give that person what their primary need is when you're saying it, and probably get on.
All right, I made a commitment to end by 9:15 to some of you, and I want to keep that. So my main goal that I just wanted to leave you with is the what I find powerful is the awareness of this concept of a crucial. Just certain conversations turn powerful; they turn very emotionally charged; they turn high stakes. And to be aware of that, and when that happens, to look for safety, make sure that you create safety. And when there is no safety, to step back and see where it went wrong, where is there retreating into a shell, where is there attacking, where is there counterattacking, and recognize that conversation has to come to a halt and start again, because it cannot be productive when it is that those things happen. So you're able to create mutual respect and being able to identify what it is that you do want and don't want and state it. This is what I'm after, not this, I'm not stating that. And being able to recognize the significance in our marriage relationships as to why they become so powerful so fast, so often, because of how much we rely, depend, and need each other for the various things that we do. If anyone has any comment, I'm happy to say for a few minutes, but I don't want to hold everybody else. I thank you for joining me. This was this particular session, this last one, was my first time presenting it, and so I hope it came out clear. And I have a couple of mental notes that I made my own. If anyone has other comments, I'm open to all of those comments and criticisms to make it into a better program in the future. But I wish you all a great night and a great marriage.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.